Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor at Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest this week is Reverend Bromley McLennigan, author of the book Good Christian Sex, Why Chastity Isn't the Only Option, and Other Things the Bible Says About Sex. Bromley is a United Methodist pastor currently serving at a United Church of Christ church in the Chicago area. I've admired her writing for some time, and so I was grateful for this conversation. We explore the reasons for and reactions to this book, where she does some deep reflection on topics that some say should never be talked about, faith and sex. I hope you enjoy it. Well, Bromley McLennigan, thank you so much for joining me on the Failing Boldly podcast.
I am delighted to be with you.
Great. Well, first question, of course, I am curious about the origin story of how this book came about and if it had been something that you'd been thinking about for some time or just kind of popped into your mind one day, or how did it all come about?
Yes, today I will write a book about sex. No, a couple things sort of came into play. One, I graduated high school, I'm pretty sure, the year that I Kissed Dating Goodbye came out. And while I grew up in the Methodist Church here in the Northern Illinois Conference, and so, and the churches that I was a part of were never, you know, purity culture-y churches, but nevertheless, that was certainly in the air and in the cultural water. And as I got a little older, and, you know, went to college and fell in love and did some dating, it seemed to me that the dominant narrative culturally was that, like, if you were a Christian, you weren't supposed to be having sex. And that was not my experience, and that was not the experience of my church friends. And so I was curious about that. So that was one thing. And then as I got into grad school, there were a number of memoirs about from young women who had been sexually active and then converted to Christianity and then were celibate because of Jesus. And that was so much better than, like, their previous terrible life of sin and loneliness and terrible things. And again, that was not my experience at all. So to some extent, I felt like there was a narrative that was not uncommon. I fell in love. I had some sex. We broke up, and then I continued in my life. And, you know, like, that narrative wasn't being told from a faith perspective. So that was one thing. The other thing is that in 1996, we saw a dramatic increase in abstinence. Funding for abstinence only sex ed, scare quotes. And then with George W. Bush, you saw even more of that. And I studied that welfare law that saw the increase in funding, in college. And then I went to grad school and studied public policy along with ministry. And by then we started to see that in addition to being cruddy, I don't know if we swear on your podcast, theology, and, like, theology sort of hidden in public school sex ed curricula. So in addition to sort of, like, all of that faulty stuff, abstinence-only education is actually terrible as a public health strategy. So, folks who take abstinence pledges and don't have any knowledge of contraception or of the mechanics of sex are not any less likely to have sex, but are far less likely to practice safer sex or to use contraception or know how to get information. And that's a public health issue. So, um, So anyway, so those sorts of things were all part of my education and part of my experience for a number of years, and something I was interested in. And I wrote my graduate thesis on that. But then eventually I got approached by an editor who said, you know, pitch a couple projects. And I pitched one that she was not taken with. And then I was like, well, I kind of been thinking about like sex and faith. And she's like, oh, that one.
I'm shocked by that. Well, maybe
I know, should, right? Yeah. That was the one they thought would sell. So, so that's sort of the long story of that. So
you mentioned that the editors seemed very excited about this. Was there anyone who was nervous about you going down this path, or were most of the people that you talked about or mentioned this to, were they pretty supportive?
Well, interestingly, it was not finally published by the first publisher that had it. And so it was with a denominational publisher and was written and edited for them, had a title and a vague seasonal date for publication. And I had to do for that denominational publisher some sort of reassurances kind of about what I was going to talk about how I see the Bible and how I think about God and how I feel about a whole range of other things. And ultimately that publisher dropped it and decided not to take it, which ultimately was good for me because then I could take my edited manuscript and sell it again to a bigger press. Where they were not as concerned about, they didn't have the same sort of restrictions, I think, on the things that they could publish under their name.
Well, since the nature of this podcast is all about how to come back from failure or disappointment or whatever, were you, when that publisher said, we're not actually going to publish this, were you able to go pretty quickly into, actually, this is a good thing? Or was, did you have a period of like, you know, what are you talking about?
I was disappointed and mad.
Sure.
When someone else has failed me, I'm generally just mad. my own failure is a whole nother story. But it actually, it became sort of serendipitous fairly quickly. The woman who had edited it, I wrote to her because I thought she really had believed in the project. And she hooked me up with her agent, who then took me on and sold the book. And so it was probably 4 months between them saying no. It was like right before Christmas. And then actually signing the contract with Harper One. I think that it is not my experience that the feeling of failure goes to greater joy in that brief and exhilarating time frame more often. Like that was sort of rare that happened. So, but yeah, that ended up being a good thing.
I didn't know that actually that this was your thesis as a grad student. And so you sounds like you had some semblance of a foundation before you even started. And then I know you also went through a process of essentially gathering data and hearing stories. And so can you talk about that? What you have the foundation, and then how did you go about hearing stories from other folks?
So two things. One, I sort of have informally received stories from folks for a long time, both within sort of official ministry capacities and just in friendships and relationships. Like I am someone who is always happy to talk to you about your relationship life. That's something that I am fiercely interested in, just and generally people have felt comfortable sharing things with me. I remember in my very first church, but early on in my ministry, I was driving with someone in my congregation who was a woman in her late 60s. And we got to talking about like trashy romance novels. And she said afterward, you know, that this was not a conversation she had ever expected to have with her pastor. And yet I think it was freeing and good to know that like that this part of her experience was not necessarily outside of the life of her faith. So the sort of just conversation, and then I worked on a college campus for a while. And so I encountered a lot of people that way. But I did want a broader, I wanted to know, my story is so privileged in so many ways. I have never had non-coercive sex. You know, I have, you know, my parents are feminists, you know, I mean, things were pretty good for me. But I wanted to know, I basically wanted to know who, if what I was saying only worked for me, right? Because that's, I think that's a test of theology. Like, does this actually work for other people? And does this ring true? The individual stories that people shared were astounding to me. And so just such a gift to kind of hear from, you know, both people's great joys and deep sadnesses and regrets and hopes and sort of all of those things.
And I think so I put together this survey and I had over 300
not what you
asked,
but I think that's what I really wanted to talk about in my context, far less than,
and
whether or not people were going to have sex
in terms
before they
of
were
survey
married,
design,
the question
was
very
disaster.
Much about
I mean, like, I never took a survey,
as you know, is still an,
I did not do super well in the church.
I actually had to look up an ex-boyfriend and be like, can you explain pivot table?
We figured it out.
Which he tried. But it was very much a justice issue. And what I wanted to talk about was,
but basically I put together a Google form
sort of what are the theological,
it took them a long time to answer it. It was
and pastoral
like
ramifications
sort
of the feelings, of, you know,
things.
Like what's
I didn't
want to
limit
about, what's desire, you know, about
gender identity. Well, so I just left
my,
that
my
as like a short
the,
answer question,
I'm
but then I couldn't
to,
actually like
about
categorize
the woman
any of them.
With whom you're in the car,
I didn't have
talking
the time
about it and
or
her
the
expressing,
Google
I never
forms,
thought that this would be where we would go with this conversation. And so,
but
I'm curious about when
you
bring together faith life and sex, there are people who probably are endlessly fascinated,
so,
but they are fascinated behind closed doors. Were you surprised that that many people responded?
Once they have the opportunity to really share, then I can imagine them really
when
wanting
I was
to
in grad school,
ask questions
we did
and share
so
their own
work,
stories. Is that your sense?
Exactly.
I think that like, once
Council
you grant
was,
the permission and ask the question,
at
people
the
are ready.
Chicago,
to,
and so we did a lot.
Many people
of,
are
and they ran
quick
like
to,
the National
to
Longitudinal
share
Survey for Youth. And so we looked at that kind of data and studies around
that. I think.
For a lot of stuff. And those are, you know, those data sets are
stories of relationship with you is that you're pretty open to in the book. And so is that something that comes naturally for you?
I had been taught that like good reliable data needs a huge
data set. I was trying to put myself in your position.
I'm like only 300 people.
And typing up a story and then stopping like, do I really want to write this?
Yeah, I was astounded.
How far do I go here in sharing the details?
Because I was serving in churches, I've always had a fairly autobiographical preaching style anyway. I mean, folks, I feel like, I do feel, without intending to sound manipulative, I do feel like by offering yourself with a certain level of vulnerability, you encourage, you know, you make it okay. You're risking something so folks feel okay risking back, right? So I'm relatively comfortable sharing details of my life with people. Your sex life is different. So two sort of principles guided that. One was that I talked a lot. I mean, I was in therapy at the time. And the only reason I'm not now is because I'm, you know, schedule changes. So, I mean, I think everybody should be in therapy. It's great. So I would like gut check with my therapist about like, how do I feel about putting this out here? And is this sort of an exhibitionist detail? Is this like, because I want to prove something about myself? Or is this furthering the story in a way that is helpful to sort of the pastoral need of it? You know, I mean, so does this story help the piece, or is this being offered for some other reason? The other thing is that I published this book in 2016, and most of my husband is in it, but mostly the early parts of our relationship, if they're there at all. So, and we got together in 2003. So a lot of these stories are from a long time ago, and they are not about my husband. So that's good, right? I like want to stay married. So I'm not going to tell the details of our relationship.
What's your sense of how the Bible plays into all of this with folks either squeamishness about talking about it, or they're thinking that this only has to be in secret? And so what is your sense of how the Bible plays into all of that?
Someone said that the Bible is the most popular book never read. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably has a great, I think that's true, first of all. And I think that fact shapes very much the way that we think about the Bible in relationship to sex. I think that and there are good reasons why we think that the Bible is not particularly sex positive. But only some of those reasons come from the biblical text. I mean, there's all kinds of terrible stuff in the Bible. But also the Bible is not as prescriptive as I think we tend to talk about. I mean, like the things that it's prescriptive about are less often modern, romantic and sexual and intimate relationships. They're far, you know, the Bible is far more prescriptive about, sort of what do right relationships look like, and not in terms of your, you know, your right positioning and practice, but rather what do we owe each other, both our intimate partners, but moreover even our families and our societies and the poor and the widow, right? So so I think that one, we put a lot of stuff on the Bible that might not always, or we assume we know what the Bible says, and we assume that the Bible offers clear prohibitions about a lot of things, where the biblical text is far more complex than that. I do think one of the primary critiques of the book that I got, even from folks who were reading, you know, who wanted to give it a positive reading and who enjoyed it and took things out of it, but particularly from a lot of former folks who had grown up in purity culture, a lot of those folks wished that I had engaged the biblical text more. Mm-hmm. But I also thought that wasn't, I mean, there's a lot written on, you know, there's a lot written deconstructing the clobber texts, and I kind of wanted to just show that there are multiple readings.
Well, let's talk about the part of your subtitle of the book is Why Chastity Isn't the Only Option. That's mm-hmm. that's the first part of your subtitle. My experience, particularly when I was a youth leader in working with youth, is that a lot of the questions, particularly if a church is really talking about abstinence and chastity, the questions kind of go around, well, how far is too far? Like those are the questions
right.
that are lifted up. And you really talk and explore, as the subtitle says, why chastity isn't the only option. And part of your exploration of that, I think, is something I really appreciated. And you're introducing Margaret Farley and the whole concept of just love. So this is kind of a big question, but I'm wondering if you could first unpack what Farley says, and then I'm curious for you, as you developed your own ethic, what went into that development?
I gave away my copy of Just Love, or not gave it away, but loaned it. I was going to pull it out before we talked so that I could make sure I got it right. But But so she lists a couple sorts of characteristics of any type of relationship. And of course, pardon me, you know, Christians talk about love a lot, and not just in terms of eros, you know, romantic and sexual love, but we talk about, you know, neighborly love and the love of God. And I think that, those typologies are useful, right? Like friend love and sexual love are different, in some ways. And I don't like thinking about the love of God as desiring an eros. I hate that, you know, like Jesus is my boyfriend language and songs, you know, those praise and worship songs that are sometimes like, yeah, I feel you close to me. You're like boyfriend or Jesus. I don't like that. But anyway, so I think those are useful, those sort of typologies. But I also think they obscure the fact that I think they obscure the sense that love of all sorts has to play by the same rules, right? So, so there's that. So Farley lists a couple of characteristics of just love. Respect for the autonomy and relationality that characterize persons as ends in themselves, and thus respect for their well-being. Respect for autonomy. People have to be able to consent and give it freely and enthusiastically. Respect for relationality. What is this relationship? And are we playing fair within the boundaries of this relationship? And I think that's about context too. Respect for persons as sexual beings in society. I think that's, and I didn't say this as clearly in the book, but I think I am here now, that I think that's about power a little bit too, right? Like, what's complicated in this interaction by the power or lack thereof that either partner has in society? And so those are sort of, those are them. And I think that those are ethical articulations of the greatest commandment to love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. And I say at some point, you know, that this is like, you know, it's so simple in some ways, and yet it's super hard apparently for us to do this. So I think that norms of mutuality and reciprocity, we're in this together, it is equal, understandings of the power that we bring.
In my experience too, and especially in working in premarital counseling and talking with other couples too, those are very intimate conversations. Mm-hmm. And to really explore them in some ways is scarier for some folks than the actual act of sex.
Right. Oh, yeah. It's so, right. Yeah. It's so much easier to like, just, you know, go for it than to name your feelings and like, right, talk through the stuff.
Talk about likes and dislikes, and this makes me comfortable, this doesn't make me comfortable.
Yeah. Or, I mean, yeah, giving voice to our fears and our desires, and not just our desires in terms of like, you know, our kinks, but like, you know, but I need to feel safe, or I need to not have to make all the decisions about this, or I need, you know, I mean, I think those are like really hard for people to know how to share. And to some extent that's, I mean, you know, detractors of this project thought that, you know, this was a no holds bar, anything goes sort of ethic. And I don't think that at all. I think it's hard to make sure that you both know where you're at and know where your partner's at any given time, and to make sure that you're treating them very well. Not just in intention, but in actuality and in fact. Go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to say, in some ways, there's I think beautiful nuance in talking about this, as opposed to some folks want clear cut answers, meaning for some who say you have to wait till marriage before you can have intercourse, and then after 3 months, then you can kiss, or after 6 months, then it's okay to get second base. You know, they want those hard and fast rules rather than diving into the nuances of these kinds of ethics that in the long run, I think make for a better sex life, but it's harder.
Yeah, it is harder. And, but it's also, I mean, in what other area of our lives do we think that, you know, that black and white, you know, clear binaries are like the right thing, right? I mean, human life is complex and people are complex. We were sitting in our like ladies book group at church yesterday and, you know, and someone said, well, so are people fundamentally good or fundamentally bad? And I'm like, yeah, both, right? Yeah. Like why one, you know? Not just one. So yeah. And it is hard. I've had so many conversations with folks who grew up in more conservative settings who talked about looking for loopholes. And there are some really great comedy skits about God's loopholes.
Well, in I haven't checked. I remember at one point I looked because I've had a feeling in looking at your book on Amazon, and even before I looked at that, I would bet there's going to be a lot of 5 stars and 1 stars, and that people, some may not even read the book, but just from the subtitle, they're going to give you 1 star because of their own. And so, was that your sense for people who? I would imagine it's all across the board for people. You mentioned this a little bit earlier, people who really appreciate it had some critique, but then there are probably also people who just are like so grateful for this book, but then others who are saying, you know, Satan wrote this book or something like that.
Right. They did say that. That is literally what some people said.
Yeah.
And so I think, I mean, with anything, like you have to believe that it is worth doing. I serve in a UCC church right now. But at the time I was writing this, I also was working at a university, and so that was helpful in sort of giving me some freedom to know that there would certainly be critique, but not worrying about it, like affecting my livelihood. Writing is not my day job or what I, you know, pay my mortgage with. But when the book came out, a number of people called both me to, you know, gently instruct me to read the Bible.
Or maybe not so gently.
Yeah, not always gently. And then a number of people called the senior pastor here to tell him that he should fire me because I'm a heretic and all those sorts of things. But other than trolls, which, you know, one encounters all over the place. I've had really, I'm deeply grateful to hear the kind of positive impact it has had for people. Folks have been really grateful and really gracious in talking about that.
Yeah. Do you have a sense, so you mentioned the study you were in yesterday, some of the basic but profound questions of are we naturally good or not? Mm-hmm. Is it your sense in both hearing from folks after the book was published and getting the 300 plus stories, how do people see themselves as sexual beings? Do you find that most people really lack confidence, that they feel like either I'm doing it quote unquote wrong, or they imagine that everybody else is having this mind-blowing sexual life and I'm not? What is your sense of people as they see themselves as sexual beings?
I think it's hard to generalize. We were talking about that because we were like, at what point in your life, we were talking about yesterday, do you stop caring about other people's opinions? And one woman in her late 40s was like, oh, probably when I was like 21. And one woman in her 70s was like, oh, I'm not there yet. So I think it just, I do think that folks long to find themselves in bigger narratives. Folks want to know that they are not the only one living a life this way. And so to hear that there are other people who are struggling, to hear that there are other people who are doing really well, to hear that there are other people who are straight and other people who are queer and other people who are, you know, I mean, I think that people need to know that they're not alone. And if they feel alone in their sexual practice, because of shame, because of what they were told at church or by their families, then that is hurtful and harmful. I think people do carry, some people carry their relationship regrets with them in a way that you might set other regrets aside more quickly. You know, I mean, I think that, if you've done something to hurt a partner, you know, that is something you feel for a long time. I think, I don't know. I mean, I think, yeah. And I do think that there are people who somehow believe that other people are having, you know, the great romances and the great sex lives and things like that. But I don't know. I also think I almost feel like that's, I always hesitate to make generational statements.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I know a lot more men in their 50s and 60s who seem to think that, like, the marriage they have is not the one that they were supposed to have, that someone else is having the great romance somewhere else, and that they should get themselves a piece of that, whereas, you know, folks in their 20s, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just because we talk to our friends more than previous generations did.
Well, that's an interesting point about the generational differences too, because in some of the articles I've been reading lately about how people are young adults are waiting longer. And so it's just, even somebody like myself, an old Gen Xer, comparing myself to a millennial or a Gen Y, it's just going to be different in the culture that we grew up in and the messages that we received, and that's going to have an impact on how we see it today.
Right. When I get real down about the future or about even the sort of current moment, I am sad for folks that, I mean, I feel like I lucked into so many things, right? Like, I feel like I lucked into my husband and I lucked into my kids and, you know, and I was talking to a graduate student the other day who was kind of, you know, who was looking for some career discernment advice. And I'm like, yeah, don't do it the way I did it. Like, some intentionality is probably better. But I worry that that there are so many pressures and there are so many things that are broken and hate filled and violent and dangerous in the world right now, that there are so many things keeping folks from sort of the fun of getting to explore falling in love, you know. So, and I think people want that, but they're also afraid of it. And sometimes for very good reasons, and sometimes just because we all have the existential fear of falling. Right.
Well, that's interesting too. In thinking about in younger generations, perhaps the fear of relationship, I mean, before there were fears around, I don't want to do something that goes against the scriptures, or I don't want to do anything that my pastor says I shouldn't do. And now, particularly as more younger generations are not in church, and so just those other fears that you're naming now could be the thing that causes some anxiety when it comes to relationships too.
Mm-hmm. There's some, I think I'm trying to think of what the title is, but there was this interesting study. Well, I mean, it's in a variety of places, but about how relationships sort of take the back burner, you know, for folks while they pursue their careers instead. And that is, I'm sorry. And that is sad to me, though understandable, right? I mean, like, if work is so tricky right now, and like it is so hard for folks to have their work support them. So the idea of starting a family, or, you know, I mean, people feel like they have to do their career first. And then somehow the pressure is on as you get older. I mean, not that it's not good to wait until you know what you're looking for. But it's interesting the way that, that these are the sort of confluence of factors that shapes people's sexual practices. Yeah. It's far less what my pastor says. Mm.
Uh-huh. Well, I always end conversations by asking folks to talk about a failure story from their own life. So if you don't mind sharing one from your life, and that can be anything professional, personal, from the failed lemonade stand you had when you were 8 to something more contemporary.
I'm so delighted that you do this. And I'm so glad that you frame things this way, because I think that we are so afraid of making mistakes and doing things wrong. And as Christians, that's so interesting to me, you know, because we like, I run this family service with like preschoolers and their parents, mostly some elementary school kids, but we do a prayer confession every week, which is always very like, you know, which is always funny. Like, what are preschoolers confessing to? But really it's to get to the assurance of great, which, you know, which is there's nothing so big and there's nothing so bad and there is nothing in all creation that can separate us from God's love.
Yeah.
That's the piece. Right. But I think so many of us don't actually believe that. So it's very hard for folks, I think, to name their mistakes and their failures. So anyway, so I think this is really important. And I've been thinking long and hard about, like, which of the millions of failures and mistakes should I share with you? One, I've blown past the deadline for my current book like 6 times. And I just can't get it right. And I that is a new experience for me in writing, and in thinking. Usually when I kind of have an idea of how something's going to go, I just am able to do it. And I haven't been able to do this in the same way as I've done other projects. And it's kind of killing me. You know, my friends sort of, you know, they duck their heads and say, can I ask you how the book is going? Like, you can, but, so that feels like a hard thing for me, and it feels like a failure, and but it will get done. Hopefully this won't come out until after my manuscript is in, and so you won't, you know, my editor doesn't need to know how nervous I am. But the other thing is I didn't write about this a lot in the book. But I was not a good friend or girlfriend in a lot of my early relationships. I was lucky. I was lucky that I was not harmed, you know, in so many of my early interactions and relationships. But like, I was really, I'm just deciding that we're going to swear on your thing, you know, but like, I was really shitty to my early boyfriends, you know, like I cheated and was sort of careless and all the things that I know to do now, or not to do now, I didn't appreciate then that you should do that, you know? And I kind of intimate that a little bit in, the Playing Fair, the ethics chapter, talking about, hooking up with a friend of mine and then and not sort of treating him the way that he deserved. Mm. I consider those sort of significant failures. And it's been curious to me to think about what to do in those times. I mean, they're long past. Everybody's, you know, everybody's married to other people. You know, I mean, those things are done. But one of the things that was really hard for me when I cheated on, I mean, and sort of the biggest betrayal for one was that I really wanted and demanded almost my boyfriend's forgiveness. He was like, no. And I was like, but I need it. And he's like, well, it doesn't matter what you think you need in this situation because you have done the wrong thing. And that was, and that felt really, again, that felt really shitty, but also was a really good learning for me. I mean, so that was a significant failure of how I felt like I should have treated this person. And there were a whole lot of reasons why it happened, but like, I was in the midst of a major depressive episode, you know, I mean, like there was some stuff going on, but nevertheless, it was a significant betrayal and it felt like a failure of the way that I wanted to love him and the way that I wanted to have our life together be. But it was really good for me to know that even in something really, that even something that is sort of mundane, a friend of mine, you know, I was grieving and angsting and all the things. And she said to me, she's like, well, everybody cheats. And I'm like, oh God, you know, I mean like, and it's true. It's not like, I mean, not everybody cheats, but like infidelity is not, it is more common than some other things. Mm. Right. But that doesn't make it good or right. It is still wrong. So that was a good, so all of the sorts of, I wish that I could have learned all those lessons without hurting him.
Yeah. Well, thanks be to God for grace and assurance.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was probably longer than you wanted.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Well, Bromley McLennigan, thank you so much for the time. You are such a beautiful writer, and I highly recommend the book to folks, Good Christian Sex, and look forward to at your own pace and on your own time, whenever the next book comes out. But thanks again for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Chris.
And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Bromley for giving her time for this conversation. To learn more about her writings and ministry, you can go to her website, bromleym.com. That's bromleigh.com. I hope you will subscribe to this podcast. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to my website, christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.